points that I made in the last class and give you a chance to raise any questions about those points, and then we move into new material. So that will be a basic pattern that we'll follow. In the last lecture, I covered the first three points on the overall class outline, A, B, and C under number one. And I stated that the overall purpose of our course can be expressed in terms of four questions. Two questions dealing with the relationship of the human psyche and the spiritual life of the Christian. Namely, how does the psyche participate in and affect the spiritual life? And conversely, how does the life of the spirit, searching for and discovering God, change or modify the states and movements of the human psyche? So the reciprocal relationships, if you want, between psyche and spirit. And the ongoing experience of the human person. And then two questions. These are secondary questions, but nonetheless important ones. Dealing with the relationship between the science of the psyche and the theology of the spiritual life. Between depth psychology and the theology of Christian spirituality. The first question, what is the place of depth psychology in the theology of the spiritual life? Second question, what's the role of theology vis-a-vis depth psychology, with regard to depth psychology? So, if you want, the reciprocal relationships between depth psychology and theology. As I say, the primary set of questions is the first. When we're dealing with this kind of question, we're reflecting on religion itself. We're reflecting on religious experience. The first set of questions. The relationship between the psyche and the spirit is a reflection on religious experience and therefore is theology. We are doing theology as we're reflecting on religious experience. When we're reflecting on science, we're not doing theology, we're doing method at this point. And those considerations are secondary, but they are things that I'm going to do some treatment of in the course of the semester. Okay. The second point, the notion of theological foundations. The point that I'm trying to make there, I want to introduce you, if you have not yet been introduced, but if you have already, to what Lonergan means by foundations, this will further explicate, I think, what he's doing there. Insofar as we are doing theology in this course, reflecting on the relationship between the psyche and the spirit, we are doing what that part, we're engaged in that dimension of theology. The following Lonergan I call foundations. In other words, we're not doing exegesis. We're not doing history. We're not doing doctrine. We're not doing systematics. Some of the things that we say will be relevant to doctrines and to systematics. We're doing foundations, what he calls foundations. And foundations is the self-appropriation of the human subject. The self-understanding of the religious moral, intellectual, psychic, human subject. We are coming to know ourselves and state how we understand ourselves, articulate how we understand ourselves as religious, moral, intellectual, psychic subject, affective subject. We're coming to state, to articulate our own self-understanding. is the dimension theology that Lonergan I refer to as foundation. It is, in his terms, it's the objectification of conversion. What is conversion? And what conversion has occurred in my own life? What experiences of conversion have occurred in my own life? It's the objectification, and it comes down at a certain point to telling the story of the ongoing conversion in your own life. Foundations is ultimately, I'm convinced, a matter of narrative. Tell the story of your own conversion experiences. How you understand them. How you understand your own history. If you want to read something with regard to what he means by a foundation, I would suggest two things. First is an article called Theology in Its New Context. Which appears in the book, A Second Collection. And in that article he argues that the old foundations for theology will no longer do. The questions, the problems of theology is dealing with demand that it move to a more radical set of foundations in conversion. And then in Method in Theology itself, it deals with foundations in chapters 10 and 11. 10 is called dialectic, but he raises the issues there for foundation. And 11, he states, he deals with foundations directly. For those of you who have some background in Lonergan, these would be worth reading. For those of you who are still being introduced to him, I would recommend this article, Theology in Its New Context. Thirdly, some major options in depth psychology and their relationship to religion. I tried to trace in the last class, in very broad sweep, very broad outline, the history of depth psychology in the 20th century, and to argue that there has been a growing recognition of religious experience as possessing its own intrinsic intelligibility, its own psychological validity, and perhaps even its own truth. A growing recognition in the history of depth psychology in the 20th century that there are certain experiences that we call religious that cannot, in fact, be reduced to more basic animal drives, but that possess their own intelligibility, their own psychological validity, and maybe even, when you read Otto Rank and Ernest Becker, they're raising the question, at least, their own truth. Is there a truth to these experiences? So I dealt very, very quickly with Freud, with Adler, Jung, and the three people that I put together on this point of the relationship between psychology and religion, namely Ronk, Becker, and Prokop, all of whom stand, as far as I can read them, in pretty much the same place. And I tried to say that even though this is the case, even though there is a growing recognition of the validity, the possible validity, possible truth of religious experience, there is still an ambiguity, even when you get to Becker, to Ronk, to Prokop. It's still a question is, well, let me put it this way. The ambiguity is there because there still has not yet been worked out in depth psychology precisely what constitutes the flourishing of the human person. What really does make for human well-being? Depth psychology has largely studied the sick, And for that reason, I think, it is much clearer on what constitutes human sickness, neurosis, perversion, than it is on what constitutes the well-being of the human person. There is not a basic foundational understanding of what makes for the flourishing of the human personality. What is a flourishing human person? How is that person constituted? And I think it's on that basis that we can come to an even better understanding of what makes for the sick person. The sick psyche. We have an understanding. Huh? We know what it is to feel it. We know what it is to feel alive in a human way, where all systems are on the go and working together. The articulation of that integration of organism, psyche, spirit, is not clear in any of those major thinkers. And that's the question that I'm going to try to address myself to in the course of this semester. Can we work out a foundational understanding of what constitutes the flourishing of the human person? And that, I think, will be a foundational issue for dealing with these sets of relationships between the psyche and the spirit, between psychology and spirituality. And it will enable us to find the link between psychology and spirituality. Too many authors and too many counselors and spiritual directors unnecessarily separate those dimensions. They need to be distinguished, but they are not separate. Distinct, but not separate. And I think if we can ask ourselves and really deal with the question, what does constitute a flourishing human personality, we will find the integration of psychology and spirituality. All right, that in very brief compass are the issues that I tried to deal with in the last class. Are there any questions on those issues before we move into this?
Yes.
I would put, you're thinking of Maslow and Ellis, Rational Therapy. I have not read his work, so I don't know. I just assume withhold judgment until I have some experience and understanding. Make the judgment there. I don't know. I've read a couple of things about Ellis, but I don't have first-hand experience.
John? Perhaps this gets back to that point you're making between self-absorption and introspection. The goal is to particularly, I guess, just about taking inward look at the most objectifying experience. That's certainly a feel for the difference between those two. When you're describing it today, it's what we're aiming for in self-appropriation of the human subject is objectifying the experience. We're telling the story of our own conversion. And immediately, I began to think, isn't there a real risk of inducing the mystery in that interaction by your trying to overanalyze or just get finer and finer tuning on it? And I'm just wondering if that's a needless concern before. And if not, now, you know, what when you're getting too close to it.
Briefly, John, I would say that if your experience itself has the dimension to it of mystery, and you experience the dimension of mystery, then in articulating that experience, the thing is to own the dimension of mystery. To own it. To claim the gift that has been given of the experience of the mystery of existence. And make that is your articulation. To articulate an experience in which the dimension of mystery comes to the forefront in your own consciousness, for instance, an intense religious experience, is to own the dimension of mystery. And if your articulation owns that in plain, then you're doing the task of self-appropriation. You are owning what has occurred in your own experience. And you can own it ever better, but again, it's a matter of having that inner feel for when you're pushing the articulation too far. I know this experience with dreams as much as with anything else. You know how far you can push the interpretation of a dream at a given point, but 6 months later, something may happen in your own experience that throws a whole new light on that. And then at that point, you own that at a deeper dimension. And it's a sense of knowing when you're forcing it. Let me put it this way, because I think this will work. I think this works for the interpretation of any experience of the depths. And it certainly works with dreams, but I think it could also be the case with prayer and with other experiences that in which the mysterious comes into your forefront. The interpretation of a dream, for instance, has to feel the same way the dream felt. As you interpret it, your feelings have to feel. They have to the same sense has to be present as was present in the dream itself. And if you're pushing the analysis to the point where you're forcing feelings that don't seem to correspond to what was in the original experience, you're moving to, you're forcing articulation, you're forcing objectification. You're overdoing it. As long as your objectification has the same affective tone to it as the original experience, or let me put it this way, in spiritual direction, if you're the directee and you are relating to your director of prayer experience, and the director is trying to give you some, throw some light on that prayer experience, ultimately you're the arbiter of that interpretation. You're the one that had the experience. Same thing with the dream. You are the ultimate arbiter of the meaning of the dream. You're the arbiter of the prayer experience as well. And the interpretation has to fit the experience. And you're the only one that can say whether it does or not. Now you, in doing that, have to be, to use the imperatives of Lonergan, you've got to be attentive, that is to say, really in the stream of the experience, intelligent, reasonable, responsible, not resisting, got to be open to that. But who is the arbiter of the meaning of an experience? It's the attentive, intelligent, reasonable, responsible person who had the experience. You're the one that makes the judgment. So you can give me an experience of yours. I can offer you a suggestion. But if you, being attentive, intelligent, reasonable, responsible, say no, that doesn't fit, I have to accept that. This is, of course, very important. The resistances, to be open to the possibilities. You don't want to resist the possibility. This will unfold, I think, more as we go forward.
I think it's a question if, in following what we just discussed, that the same feeling that has been elicited by the dream is also brought about through the interpretation and also in the spiritual direction, that a verification that one is on the right track would also be that there is an unfolding kind of quiet or sense of peace as one has that pain.
Now, true peace. We're going to talk later on about the difference between genuine consolation and false consolation. True peace is the peace of the open subject, the peace of the person who is open to the truth, and who is willing to deal with the truth, no matter how much it may demand of that person. So it's the peace of the authentic subject. The peace of the... That's Aristotle's point. Who is the person who is capable of making moral judgments? The virtuous person with a good conscience is the one who is capable of making good moral judgments. And the better person I become with a genuinely peaceful conscience, the more apt I am to make sound moral judgments. It's a matter of that self-correcting process of learning. The same thing is true here. Peace, yes. The genuine peace of the open subject. Now we're going to get into what constitutes authenticity. But there is such a thing as false consolation. This consolation is a form of resistance. Resisting the truth. It's going to work. It doesn't last too long. Yes.
I had an interesting experience about the wife of a friend of mine and myself. We tried to gently point out a real block that this fellow had. He just completely resisted. No way of getting through at all. It's quite an obvious one. Anyway, a few nights later, I'm talking a lot about dreams and big dreams and Jungian things. He had this dream. He explained it. It was a classic with numinous parts in it and whatnot. And in terms of what I knew about his life, well, here's the possibility of what the direction it might be going. It felt so right to me. He kept running it over in his mind for days and days. And the thing is, the interpretation, the feeling were right, as you said, had a lot to say with this block that he had before. It brought him around eventually to admitting that he probably was blocking it out of the conscience. Similar thing.
Yeah. See, what happens in a case like that is this, that... these events that we're talking about, the psychic events, the affective events, dream events, affective experiences in prayer and so on, which are psychic events, occur in the ongoing movement of life, the pulsing flow of life. Okay? The interpretation of those events is an attempt to find the direction that is going forward in the pulsing flow of your sensitive experience. That's why I say that the interpretation has to be the same way that the experience was. Okay? But there may be, in the flow of your experiences, the complexes of energy that are resistant to the direction that could come from a true interpretation. Those complexes, I'm just offering this very briefly now, I'm going to talk about it in detail as we get need to be dissolved. Their blockage, the blockage of energy wrapped up in those complexes needs to be healed before the person can face the truth. The complex is in the way of the truth. And there's a healing that must take place. Ultimately, I'm convinced it can take place only through love, one form or another, human love or divine love. Only from the healing. And then that energy is dissolved so that the person is open to the possibility of accepting what might be true about himself. So until that energy is dissolved, until the blockages and resistances are melted by the healing touch of love, they cannot. They can't see it. They're blind. They have scotosis, Lonergan's term for blind spot. Blind spot. Is like an eclipse of the sun. Light is blocked. And until that is touched and soothed in the course of healing.
I got a feeling it was the numinous in his dream. It was the divine touch.
That's right. That's right. Exactly. It's like divine love. Breaking right into the energic flow, into the flow of energy, and changing. Changing it, dissolving those and channeling the energy in another direction. And the person's eyes are
than they could have seen before.
And it seems to me that depending on the person, the conclusion produces possibility or negative. So, how do you comment on that?
Conversion produces positive or negative thinking.
Unlike the conversion experience, the person thinks apply in their lives is more in a positive way.
Mm-hmm.
But some others, just the negative is thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So, going back,
mm-hmm.
because the second part is about what Christ will have to do.
All right. Now, you're talking about real conversion now, not genuine conversion.
Yes.
All right. I'm going to answer that briefly now and go into it more in detail when we get into the discernment of spirits. Huh? God can break into a person's life and divine love in a couple of ways, at least. Huh? But one can be the shock of calling for change in a person's life. St. Paul on the way to Damascus. That's not a pleasant experience. Not a pleasant, it's an overwhelming, shocking experience. Alright? There's also the gentle touch of God. And everything depends upon where you are. Person into whose life God is breaking. Whether the way he takes is one or the other of these. Everything depends on you. If there is a direction that he wants you to take, and for one reason or another you are simply blind to it, and blocked, you can't see it, this may be the only way. See? May be the only way. St. Ignatius' first rule for the discernment of spirits and spiritual exercises has to do with the ways in which God touches the soul, as he uses the language that he uses. And everything depends upon where you are. If you are going in a direction that is opposite to the way in which God would have you go, and you can't see what he's doing in your life, he's going to break in through shock, through confusion, through disturbance, upsetting the flow. Whereas if you are already on the path that he wants you to walk, then his continuing guidance with you is the gentle touch of his love, which is experienced very positively. Confirming. Leading you on. Well, we'll get into this in a great deal. Well, does that begin at least to deal with
Material gain sometimes to evangelize, to get more power.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have some money to evangelize.
Mm-hmm.
Then how do you apply that method? That's the kind of possibility that we have to do. With Abraham was rich. So Christian not something old, and we have to have some gain and power, and then we can be used as the
I think that's taking us a bit away from the direction that I'd like to go in. So maybe we could talk about that privately. I think it's just really in the way that I just I'd like to move into the new material, if I may, because a lot of these things we will be dealing with in more detail. And I don't want to anticipate too much of a major discussion on some of these things. Okay, so the historical context of death psychology. What I want to do in this section is to indicate to you my interpretation of the contemporary human situation in 10 minutes. This, what again, is something that will come up and it will be dealt with in kind of spiraling fashion in the course of the semester. I want to emphasize a couple of points, though, at the beginning, just to situate what we're doing in terms of the contemporary cultural crisis of humanity. First point is the following. I believe, and this is, I'm just giving you this, this is no one else has said this, so it's just my own opinion. I think that the science of depth psychology, the understanding of the sensitive stream of our psychic experience, is one dimension of a whole new development in the history of human consciousness.